Chapter 38. The Mediterranean sun shone brightly on the decks of the Mendacium as it rocked over the Adriatic swells. Feeling weary, the provost drained his second scotch and gazed blankly out his office window. The news from Florence was not good. Perhaps it was on account of his first taste of alcohol in a very long time, but he was feeling strangely disoriented and powerless, as if his ship had lost its engines and were drifting aimlessly on the tide. The sensation was a foreign one to the provost. In his world, there always existed a dependable compass, protocol, and it had never failed to show the way. Protocol was what enabled him to make difficult decisions without ever looking back. It had been protocol that required Vianthe's disavowal, and the provost had carried out the deed with no hesitation. "I will deal with her once this current crisis has passed." It had been protocol that required the provost to know as little as possible about all of his clients. He had decided long ago that the consortium had no ethical responsibility to judge them. "Provide the service, trust the client, ask no questions." Like the directors of most companies, the provost simply offered services with the assumption that those services would be implemented within the framework of the law. After all, Volvo had no responsibility to ensure that soccer moms didn't speed through school zones, any more than Dell would be held responsible if someone used one of their computers to hack into a bank account. Now, with everything unraveling, the provost quietly cursed the trusted contact who had suggested this client to the consortium. "He will be low maintenance and easy money," the contact had assured him. "The man is brilliant, a star in his field, and absurdly wealthy. He simply needs to disappear for a year or two. He wants to buy some time off the grid to work on an important project." The provost had agreed without much thought. Long-term relocations were always easy money, and the provost trusted his contact's instincts. As expected, the job had been very easy money. That is, until last week. Now, in the wake of the chaos created by this man, the provost found himself pacing in circles around a bottle of scotch and counting the days until his responsibilities to this client were over. The phone on his desk rang. The provost saw it was Knowlton, one of his top facilitators, calling from downstairs. "Yes?" he answered. "Sir," Knowlton began, an uneasy edge in his voice, "I hate to bother you with this, but, as you may know, we're tasked with uploading a video to the media tomorrow." "Yes," the provost replied. "Is it prepped?"
"It is, but I thought you might want to preview it before upload."
The provost paused, puzzled by the comment.
"Does the video mention us by name or compromise us in some way?"
"No, sir, but the content is quite disturbing. The client appears on screen and says,
'Stop right there,'" the provost ordered, stunned that a senior facilitator would dare suggest such a blatant breach of protocol.
"The content is immaterial. Whatever it says, his video would have been released with or without us. The client could just as easily have released this video electronically. But he hired us. He paid us. He trusted us."
"Yes, sir."
"You were not hired to be a film critic," the provost admonished. "You were hired to keep promises. Do your job."
On the Ponte Vecchio, Vianthe waited, her sharp eyes scanning the hundreds of faces on the bridge. She had been vigilant and felt certain that Langdon had not yet passed her. But the drone had fallen silent, its tracking apparently no longer required.
"Bruder must have caught him."
Reluctantly, she began to ponder the grim prospect of a consortium inquiry, or worse. Vianthe again pictured the two agents who had been disavowed, never heard from again.
"They simply moved to different work," she assured herself.
Nonetheless, she now found herself wondering if she should just drive into the hills of Tuscany, disappear, and use her skills to find a new life.
But how long could I hide from them?